and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Good morning. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in my final day for Stephanie and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I get to say that only a few more times today. It's parting is such sweet sorrow. But we move into the Labor Day weekend, and everybody's going to hopefully enjoy the long weekend. And then next week, Steph and the Mooks will be back rested, tanned, sanded. I don't know what they do when they go to those spa things that they do. When they, you know, they get buffed, I guess, get a salt scrub, which I've had in my life. I've gone to a spa and I've actually had a salt scrub before. And it's an interesting sensation. You start to know what it's like, to be, I guess anything in my mother's diet. She eats far too much salt. I think that's what I'd feel like a Triscuit in my mom's diet. That's what, this is so weird. All right. Good way to start the show. This is how I deal with grief. It's been a great time, this week being on the show, and it's fantastic hearing from everybody as you guys call in. 1-800-STEP-12 is the number. Feel free to call in as we're talking about this. And we have a lot to talk about today and a huge array of guests. Jam packed. I was trying to get, another guest to even fit in all this, and I don't, it just wasn't possible. My dear friend, Jason Miller from the band Godhead, who's Jason C. Miller on Twitter. He has a solo album coming out, and is if you haven't checked out Godhead, there it's some great music, and he's a very talented guy. I was trying to get him in today, but we've got so much, it's crazy, including the incomparable Henry Rollins helping us end the show today. We've got John Fugelsang coming in, doing stunt comedy for us as well, which good, takes some of the pressure off me. We have Representative Joe Sestak, who is offering up a primary challenge to Arlen. I'm a brand new Democrat, maybe sort of, we'll see how he ends up voting in a time of crisis. Spectre. And then, of course, coming up this hour, David Sandelow, from the Department of Energy's, he's the Department of Energy's Assistant Secretary for Policy and International Affairs. And we're going to talk about oil and all things Afghanistan and all things. I want to talk to him about wireless energy and see if he knows anything about it, because I was so excited about that nerdy story yesterday that I'm still buzzing on it. That ended up being the biggest story for me and my friends yesterday, was the idea that wireless energy will be, according to an offshoot company from MIT, will be the norm in 5 years. In 5 years, no wires, kids. Think of all the lack of annoyance in your life that you don't have to deal with when you have to find a plug and plug your phone in. It will just charge on its own when it's near a certain power point in the room. But beyond that, think of all the metal we reclaim for all other uses that we're now using just to run cables. It would be fascinating to imagine a day when you're driving down the street and there are crews removing the electric poles. That would be a stunning, amazing day. And it's not that far off, apparently. I'm very excited. I'm sorry. I get very Star Trek-y about these things. That kind of work, by the way, will come, cannot come soon enough, because not only are we in a recession, 87%, I believe, people believe we're in a recession, which I don't know, since I guess some recessions are driven by public confidence. I guess that matters hugely. But not only are we in a recession, but we are also apparently in a man session. Watch this. Tony's going to play something for me while I explain this to you. That's right. Women are the victors in a man session, according to the Times Online. In Solutions at Work, the man session, women surpass men in the workforce. USA Today had an article that said women take over the job market, that later on they had to soften the title of, because misogynistic men's groups who fear any advances by women complained, and they got it changed to women make historic gains as men lose jobs, which I can see how that's a big win. Yes, it's true. Women, apparently, we're going to start the lyrics, hold on. That's not true. Women work during the day. They are taking better care of themselves. That's true. They're saying it's the first time in economic history, but no, 1940, apparently, women also surpassed men for a while. Well, she's looking. She's got more job options than you. That's why she's looking out the door. That's good. We can cut that because I'll be so distracted by any Hall & Oates song that you play. Apparently women have been gaining in the job market while men are falling way behind. And I think it's largely, I mean, obviously the biggest drop in jobs has been in manufacturing. And the biggest gains have been in education, social services, areas that are traditionally favored by women, which is a nice way of saying that men have always thought, well, we'll just hand off crap jobs that we don't want to women, and then all of a sudden they're the only ones left, and now we're mad about it. I don't know. I think it's mensnewsdaily.com. Which is a great when you're making a URL, kids. You might not want to run two words with S's at the ends because it makes you sound like your English is bad. It's silly, but anyways, it's one of these male panic sites where you know if things don't go completely the white male way, everybody starts writing these letters about how it's going to be the demise of the world. Fantastic little moment that's very telling, I think, and aimed towards a lot of the people who are freaking out the most about this. But at one point, the reporter commendably veered away from the predictable liberal lies. For years, Democrats have claimed that women have been subjected to wage discrimination, noting that women earn 77% of what men make. But this time, USA Today admitted the true cause of the gender gap. On average, women work fewer hours than men and hold more part-time jobs. May be true, but that's not the point. That 77% figure comes from what women get for the same work. So if a woman and a man have a part-time job, she usually makes 77% of what he makes. If a man works fewer hours on the same scale as a woman, she still makes 77%. So that's they're being fast and loose with the facts in that one. But it's fascinating, and I would be interested to see if that's been your experience. Ladies, if you call in, and I have no ulterior motive in asking you to call in, but if you want to call in and say, like, how secure you feel in your job versus the men out there, you know, I personally think part of the thing that is a shift in the kind of jobs we do as a country, because as you move up as a first world country, a lot of your manufacturing and is naturally going to move overseas in the same way that it moved downstream. Originally, everybody made their own clothes, and then eventually somebody in town got good at making clothes, and so they formed a workforce to make all the clothes for everybody, and other people moved on to other jobs. And, you know, this is, I mean, I'm going back to, like, you know, fiefdom and fiefdom and you know, almost feudal society kind of technology and economies. But then as you grow up, you know, we get more kind of management style jobs. We get into areas where we're not actually doing the physical work. And I think in many ways as a country, that's where we're headed. And when you hear Obama and others saying we have to be ready for the economy of the future, it is going to require a lot less physical labor there, you know, not just because of, you know, the offshoring of certain jobs, but of course because of automation and you know, even the auto mechanics of today have to be more computer savvy than the auto mechanics of maybe even 15 years ago. So there's a job shift in the kind of jobs we're going to be doing, and the focus on, you know, men as physically strong and therefore doing manufacturing and labor intensive jobs is shifting away. It just is. And I think even the jobs for men are going to go in that direction. I just think there's a turnover point. It's going to be fascinating to see. But I got to nerd out because we have people calling in already, and it's really cool. But Aaron in LA wants to talk about wireless tech. Aaron, you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
There is in regard to your wireless technology.
Sure.
There's a science fiction fantasy book by Barbara Hambly.
Uh-huh.
And in it, that wireless technology becomes so obtrusive because all they get is 24/7 advertising.
Right, spam, you mean?
And you can't even escape from it.
Right.
It's in your living room. It's that kind of wireless where you don't even have to have a television. It's just projected in your house.
Wow.
That type of thing.
That would be a little difficult to do, because anything optic has to have some form of light source coming from it, and they'd have to, I don't know how they would manage to make your skillet, you know, display an image. But, I mean, I'm not ruling it out. Obviously, in, Minority Report, his, every time he shook his, cereal box, it played a cartoon.
Right, something like that.
Yeah, that's not far off. I mean, they've already have the paper-thin display, has been available for years now, and they're using it for larger events, but it's eventually going to be, like, movable foldouts and papers. That stuff is kind of coming. But the... But what I'm talking about is wireless energy.
Right, that's what I'm talking
about. More than, you know, more, yeah. Wireless energy will be just how batteries are charged and how devices are powered.
Right, but so you
rather than information.
But all it does is the technology in that book, I think it's such that you don't even, I mean, you don't even have to have a display hardware. It's projected into your home.
Right.
Automatically.
That would be a bit difficult,
yeah.
Especially because you know, if they did have that, we would all, believe me, I would be the first guy on doing a TV infomercial selling personal EMP.
Well,
yeah.
Okay.
Electromagnetic pulses you carry in your purse that just kills all computers in a 10-foot radius.
Well, that's the joy of the DVR, because you can just flip through those commercials.
Absolutely. You can speed past them. Thank you for your call. I appreciate
Thank you.
It. I'm so nerded about it. And this, Michael in L.A., a lot of L.A. people, very excited about this, because we all drive and have to deal with electronics probably more than the rest of the country. You there, Michael?
Yeah, I'm right here. I've known about the wireless electricity for quite some time now. In fact, Tesla, right?
Absolutely, Nikola Tesla.
Yeah.
He was building a large. He was going to use the ionosphere to project energy so that you could power ships without them having to have any kind of an engine at all. And I want to say it was Carnegie who pulled the plug on it because he couldn't figure out a way to charge for it.
Well. The coolest thing about it is that nothing will, if they get it, the instrument sensitive enough, nothing will need a battery because it'll be able to be powered off the largest battery in the universe. And you know what that is, right?
The sun.
No.
Us.
No. Our own battery, our own local battery, the Earth, with a spinning core and a north and a south pole.
That's true. The magnetic pole.
We won't need any batteries for anything. We will have unlimited power because we just get it from the Earth.
Right. Well, there's, you know, and the other thing is they've been trying to capture the power of what they believe is the cause of gravity, which is gravitons. And if they were able to do that, then all propulsion would be unnecessary. You just have, you know, airplanes wouldn't need engines to take off or fly. They just, you know, I can't believe how nerded out I'm getting right now. Because here's the thing. Here's the thing is, and you talk about how the economic stuff that we're dealing with, you know, and the economic issues.
It would be all gone.
All gone, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then
definitely.
Start dealing with, you know, furthering our life experience. You know, we stop worrying about how am I going to pay for gas. Let's say you took that entirely out of the equation in your life. You never have to pull over for gas again. This is the
breathe the fumes.
Right. Or clean up after the mess. Or we don't have to worry about recycling vehicles in the same way that we would have to, because it's just the combustion engine, the wear and tear on it is a totally different animal. You don't have battery storage. You don't have the mercury from that. All those things. But I mean, on a personal level, you no longer have to pull over for gas ever again. What does that do to your life? How much time does that add at the end of your life? What do you think people pull? How much time? It's one of those things where you add it up and you're like, oh, my God, I can't spend it. Over the course of my life, I spent 3 years.
It's the time that you wait in line. Over your life.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's like 3 years of my life are dedicated to pulling over and filling up my tank with gas. That's now gone. What do I do with that 3 years that I get back in my life? There's an entire generation that's coming up that in the next 10 years will have none of the experience that we have in that. I'll let you go because
I wish it could happen in my lifetime, but I'm afraid
a good deal of it will. A good deal of I mean they're saying
yeah,
5 years, but
yeah,
I mean
I won't be 20 to be experience it.
But your life expectancy has gone up through the roof. I mean the human body can last 250 years. We already know this.
Yeah.
Not
the way mine's polluted. But.
Well, there you go. See, that's the trick, isn't it? You know, it's really going to be about keeping your body hot as long as possible. I think that's really going to be the biggest concern. Look at the boomers, and that'll tell you. Thanks for the call. Absolutely. Everybody talks about in the economy that, oh, what are we going to do? And, you know, there's just nothing, you know. Almost like there's no, we built everything that we're going to build. We designed everything we're going to design. It's just a fait accompli that, you know, human progress is over and therefore we're just kind of stuck here. And we can't see a future where, you know, manufacturing or technology, you know, reaches another level beyond what we have. I mean, we stare at the iPod and we go, oh, my God, how could we possibly do anything better than this? I mean, we really have peaked out. But there is. There's so many areas where we haven't advanced at all in the last 50 years. And this is where the future is. And this is what I believe Obama's push towards science, towards green energy and green technology. This is really where this is going. You know, and we'll talk about this a little bit after the break. And I'll take some of your calls. We've got a bunch of people, and I don't want to lose the time to be able to do that. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away. And I'm just holding down the fort during the man session. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Who are those freaks?
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
But it's the wise man that isn't.
I gotta say, I know I nerd out too much about this, but I think it can't be overstated what a shift in lifestyle and culture will happen when we move away from combustion engines and we move away from wired energy. You know, when we start viewing how we use metals to transmit energy as a waste. It's going to be a game changer, and the you know, like I said, what the iPod did to the you know, to the record companies, you know, and digital download, the electric car and wireless energy will do to the oil companies, and it's a you know, it's going to be a huge shift, and I you know, I'm so for it. Matt in Madison, Wisconsin. I've only got a minute, but you're going to touch on something about wireless tech that I, you know, has been bugging me for a long time as well.
Yeah. Actually, you know, Nikola Tesla,
mm-hmm,
invented
Nikola.
This.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
He invented this a long time ago, and you know, in my opinion, it's probably been suppressed.
Probably.
I
think there's no argument that it has. And I think when you move away, if you look at how we've been paying for our energy and how we've been receiving it, you know, and not ways that are sustainable, in ways that are based on a limited resource. And I've only got a minute left. If you look at how we've used it and how we've paid for it, it's defined our society in a lot of negative ways. And if you
Absolutely.
Move past that, once you get to the point where wireless energy is available to everybody on a solar or wind-based and it's just a natural part of our lives, then we spend more of our time paying for the things we want and the advancements in our culture and the advancements in our life than we do just paying for gas, as it were. And now that's outweighing the industry strength of gasoline, you know, that's slowly but surely becoming more important to us than,
yeah,
you know, than the oil company's grip. And that's really going to be, that's really where the shift is coming. Thanks for the call. I got to take a break. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller, all this week, which just means today. I've got David Sandilow right after we come back from the break. 1-800-STEPH-12. I'm Hal Sparks. This is the Stephanie Miller Show.
I'm tired of being right.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. On the line right now, I have David Sandilow. Am I pronouncing it correctly, sir?
You got it. Hal,
thank
good
you.
Morning.
Good morning. From the you're the Department of Energy's Assistant Secretary for Policy and International Affairs, which is, I have to say, a very impressive title.
Well, it's a lot of fun.
I can imagine. I don't know if you've heard any of it, but we've been nerding out about the apparent report from an offshoot company from an MIT group that says that wireless technology will be the standard in 5 years. Of course, that makes the Star Trek nerd in me go crazy. Where do you see the future of energy? I mean, you of all people.
I say, hey, you know, look at it this way. Mm-hmm. Just think 20 years ago, did anybody you know own cell phones back then?
Right.
You know, maybe a few, but today almost everybody does. Looking forward, mm-hmm. I think 20 years from now, I think my grandkids are going to look at my kids and say, what, you couldn't plug in cars back when you were young? That's so weird.
Right.
We are going to change the world as much with clean energy technologies in the next 20 years as we change the world with information technologies in the past 20 years, I believe. But that's only... By the way, that's mm-hmm. only if we get it right. That's only if we pass federal legislation to provide clean energy incentives. It's only if we keep on the path that President Obama has put us on in the past year to really invest in our future in this area.
I agree. There's not a question, I think, of when it's going to be done, because it will come. It's a question of will America be involved? And it's sad that we have to sort of legislate that to exist, but you know, we've had a history in this country of companies and corporations kind of not investing in this kind of technology because they didn't think it was profitable or they thought it ate into their other profits. And so we're kind of behind the eight ball in some areas, and we're going to be playing catch-up.
Hal, you're 100% right. I've been to China twice in the past 2 months, and let me tell you,
man,
they're investing in clean energy. And
yep.
And you know what? If they invest in 21st technologies and we invest in 20th century technologies,
yeah,
let me tell you who's going to win.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, we got to be out in front, ahead of the curve. In too many cases in the past couple of decades, we've actually gotten behind the curve on some of the stuff. And, not many Americans know, I think, that the technology for the Prius battery was actually developed right here in the United States, but then it was commercialized in Japan. The technology for the photovoltaic cell, solar cells, was developed here in Bell Labs in the United States, and now the biggest producers are abroad. We need to use American innovation to create jobs here at home, and that's why the Recovery Act that President Obama signed is so important. That's
right.
Why we need to pass this type of federal legislation in order to really give clean energy incentives for the future.
Well, yeah, I do not understand, and this is, you know, perhaps I'm far too on the progressive side, but I can't even, it just seems so backwards thinking to not focus on a green economy and not think on new alternative, because when you're dealing with a limited resource that's eventually going to run out, the sensible thing is to look to the future and go, not only what are our alternatives, but what are our best alternatives and that aren't resource-based. And so solar and wind and hydroelectric power, tidal power, these seem like these are the kind of things that don't go away over time and give us a position where we're not relying on foreign sources of oil, where we don't, our commuter traffic is not based on that. This seems very logical, and it's strange to me that we actually had to... You know, that we are having to legislate this into existence.
You're 100% right, Helen. And I think the other key point here is energy efficiency. We waste so much energy
right.
in this country, and it's like trying to run a race with a ball tied around your ankle or something like that. You know, just think about this. How many people out there know how much electricity their refrigerator uses, and how much it costs every year, or how much their dryer uses, or their TV? And, you know, it's kind of astonishing we don't even know that.
Right.
When I go to the store to buy a refrigerator, if one of them costs $699 and the other costs $799, that makes a big difference to me.
Mm-hmm.
But then I tend to ignore how much electricity it's going to use and cost me over the course of the 10 or 20 years that I have this refrigerator.
Right. That $100 difference actually means $700 or $1,000 difference over the life of the
Yeah. I mean, it's not logical. And just with basic, simple energy energy-saving techniques, we can save ourselves money, we can improve our economy, and by the way, you know, cut pollution that's threatening the planet.
Right. Well, and you know, beyond the planet, you know, this is also the other argument I make, that, you know, when you run up against the climate change deniers, my response is and has always been, you know, pollution itself from the combustion engine as we use it for cars results in 100,000 children going to emergency rooms a year for asthma-related and respiratory illnesses and problems. 100,000. That is totally preventable in a move towards a non-combustion engine type of economy. That's reason enough. Even if you don't believe that climate change is coming, which I think is an absurdity, but even if you don't believe that, at least care about the direct effects on our health, our own, you know, city pollution that's very obviously caused by, you know, how we use energy and how we misuse energy, and can be solved.
Amen. I mean, first of all, the scientific consensus could not be more clear.
Right.
We have got a crisis here with climate change. Second of all, as you say, that this threatens children with local air pollution. And third, we can create jobs by solving this problem. It's already happening around this country and around the world. So this is the way of the future.
Yeah, this is, you know, we should take, if we're going to take pride in America and, you know, and be kind of all Lee Greenwood about this, you know, one of the things we should look at is just how far America has taken the rest of the world in computer technology. And if we took that, you know, that kind of a lead in energy technology, we would secure our position as a world leader for decades, if not, you know, centuries.
There's no question. Look, we just announced $2.4 billion of grants to support the electric vehicle industry in the United States. And that is the type of step that is required, I think, in order for us to build an industry that's going to transform the future to really, you know, get ahead of the curve here. One critical point is this really is up to the people. I mean, this, as we've seen in these discussions of health care in the past month, this is a vibrant democracy that we live in. And, you know, people who have strong convictions, they need to make sure their voices are heard. You know, if you are a strong believer in our clean energy future, it's very important to make your voice heard.
Absolutely. And vote with your dollars and vote with your feet. You know, it's interesting to me. And this is, I think, was very striking in the last year to a lot of people, in the last 8 months. I think specifically one of the biggest turns I've seen in industry in the world is when the Obama administration dealing with the auto industry and going, look, we'll help you out, but you've got to show us something for it. And the end result was we went from one last year. Car companies saying, look, we've tried electric technology, we've tried hybrid technology, and we just can't get over, you know, an extra 10 miles of miles per gallon on any car. And all of a sudden, this year, they're starting to talk about cars that have a 360-mile range on a single charge.
I mean, we've got these hybrids out on the road, like the Prius, that use both an electric motor and gasoline. We could add to that what's called flex fuel, which means it would also take, you know, biofuels, which can be done in an environmentally sensible way. And once you start doing those technologies combined, so you've got electricity and biofuels and gasoline in a car, you can start getting, I'm not making this up, 500, 600, 700 miles a gallon.
Right.
I mean, it's astonishing. And we need to move in that direction. We need to move. So it is crazy that we are spending $1 billion a day for purchases of foreign oil. That's not good for our national security. It's not good for our economy, and it sure is polluting the planet.
It's $365 billion a year. We have been hearing back and forth about how we can't. It's healthcare is going to cost us $30 billion a year. You know, $1 trillion over the next decade, and we cannot afford it. And yet, we comfortably and blindly spend $300 billion a year on just foreign oil. That seems to me an extraordinary lack of connection on our part as an electorate.
Absolutely.
And an easily solvable one.
It's time for it to end, and the best answer here, there are a number of answers, but the one that's most powerful is the plug-in electric car, which,
right.
I know, as I said, I think it's the wave of the future. I think my grandkids someday aren't going to believe that I didn't plug in a car when I was young.
I think they're not going to believe that you actually had to plug it in, because I think there's going to be resonant energy technology that will happen in parking spaces. You won't even have to connect it physically to anything. Yeah.
No, I think that's a very visionary approach, Al. Absolutely. I think that type of thing is possible. And, you know, these electric cars, by the way, they're fast, they're quiet, and they're cheap to drive, by the way. They cost the equivalent of 75 cents a gallon to drive.
I have a Prius myself. I'm a fan. The Leaf is coming out next year, the Nissan Leaf that's a plug-in electric. The Chevy Volt is supposed to be a game changer for them. I think most of us are looking at this technology the way we look at our cell phones and the way we've looked at our iPods and our laptops over the last 10 years, and we look at the fact that car vehicle technology, has moved at such a slow pace compared to every other form of technology that if our cell phones had advanced at the same level that cars had advanced, we would have physical dials on our phones still. You know, it's absurd, and I think now we're finally catching up. And I think that it's fantastic that after the Bush administration's issues with just being so oil focused, that Obama is taking this like a 180 degree turn. That this is, I think, our first non oil focused administration that we've had in 50 years.
Look, this clean energy future is a top priority of President Obama's. It's also a top priority of my boss, Energy Secretary Steve Chu. And some of your voters might know this, but Steve Chu won the 1997 Nobel Prize in Physics and is, I believe, a transformational Secretary of Energy. President Obama showed extraordinary vision in picking him. And Secretary Chu was motivated to public service by reviewing the scientific literature, seeing the threat that global warming posed, and then seeing the economic opportunity that this clean energy economy offered. And I think it's really, the opportunities here are just extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. Not just for our own environment, but also for our economy. You know, this is the economy of the future, and if we want to be a part of it, this is the thing that will make the difference in this country becoming, the profitable, affluent country that we like to picture ourselves as being. David Sandalo, thank you so much for being with us, and keep up the good work. And I will encourage everybody to contact their congressperson about cap and trade, about environmental policy, and make sure you keep up the pressure on, because after we deal with health care, the next thing will be, how do we stay healthy? And energy is one of the ways. So thank you so much.
Great talking with you, Hal. Thanks much.
Appreciate it. We're going to take a break. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie on the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm going to come back to your calls in just a moment, and we'll talk. I mean, it's lighting up with the wireless energy and the electric car conversation. It's something we're all very excited about. It's Nerd Central here. 1-800-STEPH-12.
It's a beautiful miracle of nature.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. They got just a couple of days left. They got the long Labor Day weekend, which is fantastic. And I hope you guys enjoy your Labor Day weekend as well. I want to get to a lot of these calls, too, because I've been dealing we've been talking about technology. And I really do think this is the game changer for America, if we can really focus on this. And this is the positive aspect. You know, Obama wants to talk to the school kids next week to say, make some goals for yourselves, what you want to learn. I mean, the right wing is going, crazy. I almost said the B word. They're going insane because they think he's indoctrinating them into a socialist army, when really he's just wanting them to focus on science and math skills, because a lot of kids bail on it. And this is the technology of the future. This is the area of growth in the future. Americans will not be, the next revolution in American society will not be an industrial one. It will be an information-based and scientific and technology one. And it won't be about building the stuff. It'll be about designing the stuff and repurposing the stuff and making stuff more efficient. And if we can focus on that, that becomes, we will think about innovation the way we thought about steel production in the early parts of the 20th century and the late 19th century. So I'm going to go to Robert in Los Angeles. Robert, you there?
Yay.
Hey.
What's happening, buddy?
How are you? Oh, it's Robert Kane, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, what's happening, Hal?
It's good to talk to you. Robert and I are good friends and are actually working on a documentary currently about freedom, which I will talk about in the coming weeks as I visit doing Hump Days with Hal with Stephanie.
Absolutely, and I want the freedom not to sit in traffic any longer.
Thank you. Yes, that's the idea, right?
You know, great, great topic, by the way. This is so right on the news point of the day.
Right.
Coming up for me was, if you look at the who killed the electric car issue,
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of tie into big oil,
right.
Solar voltaic. We wonder if Jimmy Carter was going to put panels on the White House
right.
a million years ago.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think he did. He started putting them up, and Reagan took them down as a spiteful kind of just nanny nanny foo foo kind of attitude towards it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I have another take on that,
mm-hmm.
and it's called localism,
mm-hmm.
because what nobody that I know can kind of walk out in the backyard and spike an oil well and start making gasoline.
Right.
But any single one of us, if you notice, mm-hmm. can put a photovoltaic array
yeah.
on the top of our house and start making electricity.
Absolutely.
If the energy companies can't control the flow, they can't charge for it. It reduces. It gives everybody in the country empowerment.
Right. Well, I was also, some of the people have made this argument. I think you make an excellent point. Some people have made the argument that, if they can't charge, they're not going to let this technology through because they can't charge for it. And they're going to really put the fist down on it. Well, if you start making electric cars, like I'm making, if I'm making an electric car, I don't have to worry about the energy company. I'm not,
right.
As a matter of fact, I'm now at odds with them. I want my car to require less energy because I'm making a specific product, that's one of my sales points. For years, horsepower has been our sales point, and whether we used it or not, it's just this potential energy that we never actually,
right.
functionally use. And the car companies and the oil companies have been hand in glove for years. Well, now an electric car salesman has no vested interest in a utility company any more than Apple has with making their laptop batteries have to be charged all the time. It makes no sense. So once we move towards an electric car, you get away from that death grip that the oil companies have on us.
I agree. There's one element that I would say that ties the electric companies and the car companies together,
mm-hmm.
and that is an electric car requires almost no maintenance.
Right.
Car dealerships don't make a lot of money. They make about $1,000 at the top end on your average car.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you got to sell a lot of cars every year to support that giant lot, that giant staff.
Right.
They make their money in the maintenance department. Those repair shops are buzzing 24/7 practically.
Right, that's
electric
true.
Electric cars have very little maintenance. The motors are stronger than a gas motor. They're mm-hmm. Infinitely stronger.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Well, they last a long time.
Yes.
Because they don't have the combustion engine problems in that regard. And the thing is, the technology as we understand it, even as good as it is, it's nowhere near what it could be because we haven't even advanced in this area. We have literally held
exactly.
this technology back for decades intentionally. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
You watch it drives me crazy, and I talked about this with David Sandilow.
Good segment, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. And he, I think everybody is aware that, we've been sitting on this technology for a long time. Car companies have known for a long time what they're capable of. They just had no financial incentive to do anything about it until Toyota came up with the Prius,
yeah.
which I was talking with Tony, our board op, and I'm gonna let you go because I'm coming up against a break and
That's
stuff.
Right.
It's great to talk to you, Robert Kane. You're always awesome.
Right on.
Cheers. We were talking about this, and the Prius and the Prius, as great as it is, will look like, I think, in the history of the vehicle, like the Sony Discman. There was a point where the Sony Walkman came out, and we were using cassettes, and cassettes were an archaic way of delivering music. But they were, you know, you could record on them, you could buy them straight from the store. They were very versatile and fairly shockwave resistant, but you couldn't jump from song to song, and there was a lot of social experience that we didn't get out of it. So they came up with the Discman. The Discman skipped, but at least you could jump from song to song, and it gave you certain value or whatever. But it was a stopgap between the Walkman into the digital march towards the iPod, and the iPod is now the standard in that regard. This is where we are with car technology right now. The Prius, at best, is the Discman, and we're years away from even like the next plateau of technology that will make us look back at the combustion engine and think that's just what a ridiculous waste of time. How, you know, it was the combustion engine will look like, I think, in the history of vehicles, and like a failed experiment, a short-lived in the span of time, you know, a short-lived 80-year experiment that did us more harm than good. We'll be back right after this. 1-800-STEP-1-2. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm going to take your calls at the top of the hour.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Ford loves the working man. Don't trust Whitey. See a doctor and get rid of it.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks. I love that clip. It makes me laugh every time I have to play it. 1-800-STEP-1-2 is our number. I've got a nice big chunk, so I want to go to the phones a lot because this is a great topic. We're talking about the future of American energy, American technology, and American education, and it all dovetails towards the new economy that I think Barack Obama is intending to make, and I think will be the primary focal point of his legacy in this first term. I'd like to talk to John in Chicago, because apparently your company converts cars to electric?
No, actually, what our company does is convert cars to burn E85.
Okay.
And like you say, in the future, electric cars are probably going to be the way to go. But
right.
In the meantime, what we can do as Americans is actually support Americans by using American fuel, which is ethanol, which is grown, you know, from corn. And actually, there are plenty of other ways that they could make it right now.
That's true. What do you think about the algae farms that are growing that they're using to create fuel as well? Do you think that's a good alternative in the future as well?
Yes, it is. Actually, all this will tie in electric biofuels, you know, as a future, you know, as we go along, we could definitely become energy dependent.
Right.
And, in the way it is now, like you say, you have the Prius.
Yes.
And it's like the portable Walkman, whatever.
Right.
But, you know, what you could actually do is make that a tribrid and actually burn E85 also with the electric. So now not only are you using electric, you're using American fuel when your electric motor isn't working.
That's great. That's fantastic. What's the name of your company?
JohnnyEnergy.com, JONNY.
Okay. JONNYNOH. JohnnyEnergy.com. Well, cool. I think people should look into it. Thanks a lot, John. Appreciate
sure.
it. And you live in Chicago, which makes me very jealous because it's my favorite city in North America, hands down. Jonathan in Miami, Florida. There. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going great, man.
What I wanted to talk about, right, is that, it's so funny how the Bush administration took us backwards, because now it's like we have all these opportunities to develop green energy, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I see people out there screaming about healthcare, screaming about like, oh my God, I don't want it. And it's something that's going to take us a step forward. And, you know, like yesterday I was at home with my girlfriend and I saw stuff about OLEDs. I don't know if you heard about that.
It's sure.
organic light emitting diode, which makes like your TV paper thin. And
right.
I can't believe, you know, we're taking so long to invest in that stuff. And I just, you know, I hope Obama's going to take us forward. You know what I mean? That's what I want.
Well, I think, if you look at, and thanks for your call. I appreciate it. You know, if you look at what he's been talking about and what he's been pushing for since the day he got in office, and his education system, you know, the stimulus package had a lot of money specifically for education. This address next week is really about, you know, kids setting goals and I think really trying to focus on getting American kids to focus on math and science once again, because this is where the jobs of the future are coming from. It's not a matter of whether or not he's doing it. There's no question that Obama has a very specific science and technology focused agenda, a growth for America. In many ways, I call him, you know, he's looking to be the Steve Jobs president. You know, that there's this idea that we have no idea what we're capable of until we start doing it. But we do have to focus on science and technology. The question is, will we live up to it? And, you know, when you've got these parents pulling their kids out of the president's address because they think it's socialism for him to tell them to have goals about their own academics and drive themselves towards their own, you know, start thinking about what they like in regard to school and focusing very heavily on it. If they like science, don't be afraid to like science. You know, it's the first truly nerd president we have is driving that discussion that way, and I think it's really healthy, and we need it as a country. The way we've been living is not sustainable. The technology we've been living with is not sustainable, and every other country in the world is looking to move forward in this area. And if the day we're behind China in technology is the day when, you know, you can put a pin in it. You know, we're kind of done. I want to go to Steve in Canton, Ohio. Steve, you there?
Hey, Hal, how's it going?
It's going great.
Good. Hey, these extreme conservatives should read a book called The World is Flat. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I have. It's a good book.
Thomas Friedman.
Yeah. I think they fear that in a lot of ways. I think, you know, you have people that almost view education on on math and technology and sort of the future technology in the same way that, like, an old person views a new cell phone. You know, they have this kind of technophobia about it, and that technophobia pushes out into, you know, how they view policy, how
right.
They think people should vote. I mean, it's one thing to go, I don't want to text because that's not what I do. I'll just use my phone as a phone. But it's another thing
right.
to kind of push your legislator in the same direction.
Right.
Yeah, I appreciate it. The world is flat. Thomas Friedman, absolutely. Cheers. Thank you. Let's go to Matt. Matt's going to ask a very important question. Matt's in Madison, Wisconsin. Matt, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hello?
You're on the air.
Awesome. Well, I wanted to say, you earlier had mentioned that losing manufacturing jobs was part of becoming a first world economy. But I wanted
Certain kinds of them. Yes, but go ahead.
But I think it's just as important as the same time that we push, you know, the green jobs and the science and research aspect of it, we need to be reviving manufacturing in America, because if you look at any economy that got so strong classically in history, everything from, you know, United States as it was before we kind of went down the tubes, to Japan, to now China,
uh-huh.
all of it had really strong manufacturing. All the economies that really became superpowers had very strong manufacturing, and I think we need a way to get all the manufacturing jobs back to America rather than shipping more and more of them overseas. I'm not sure if Obama's going to do that.
I do think he is going to do that, and I appreciate the call. I think it's an excellent point. I do think he is going to do that. I just think they're going to be different kinds of jobs. I just don't think the like steel plant jobs are the kind of jobs that have growth to them. They will definitely exist in this country. We will actually have those. But the biggest growth in jobs and in manufacturing will largely be in higher tech areas. And I don't think we're going to be making circuit boards in the country in the next 5 years. We may over the next decade, as things get more and more complicated and cheaper and easier to make and more automated. But again, the human beings on the assembly floor in the United States will be running large automated systems. They'll just be more complex jobs. The manufacturing jobs just won't be as physical and labor intensive as they have been in the past. And I think we have to prepare for that. I think we have to mentally prepare for that. I think we have to prepare for that in our education system. So let's go to, where is it, Corey in Detroit. which is a city that's definitely been affected by the shift in manufacturing, the kind of jobs, and the obviously the auto market. Corey, you there?
Absolutely, Hal. You're doing a great job, I have to say, first off.
Thank you. You don't have to say that, but I'm glad that you did.
Oh, I had to say it. It's been wonderful listening to you all week.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
There are two things I want your opinion on.
Okay.
The first thing, there's a fundamental flaw in the way corporations do business. For instance, the auto industry, they have been insanely short-sighted. They've been focusing on quarterly earnings instead of investing in long-term technologies that will give them the lion's share of what they should have been doing
right
10, 15 years ago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, working not only not doing the job, but working against having to do the job. You know, they spent so much money that they should have been spending on R&D. They spent on, you know, legislating against states like California to keep their, you know, the emission standards high so they wouldn't have to innovate, which is insanity in a modern technology kind of environment. But go ahead. You keep going.
The other thing, just politicians, they're fundamentally flawed because they're human. They're more concerned about getting reelected than they are about doing what's right. And how do you get past those two fundamental flaws in corporations and in politicians who are just humans and they want to keep their jobs?
I think I have an answer on both fronts, and they're not simple solutions, but I think they exist, Corey. I appreciate the call.
Okay.
Yeah. The first one being is that I think a lot of companies focus on quarterly profits and are very future focused. I think it's about the corporate mentality. I think modern technology companies, Google, Apple, those kind of companies, they still make their money in quarterly profits like every other corporation, but they focus in a 5-year plan kind of a way or a 10-year plan. And since they deal in technology, they are constantly innovating. To them, you know, the technology that seems 10 years off in the future, they want it now because they think that will help them in a quarterly and in a yearly and overall in the, you know, in the success of a company. There are companies that deal with that. It's just that traditionally the car companies, because they've been dealing with the oil companies hand in glove, they've had no impetus to do this. There's been no push. Now the consumer, the environmentalist, and the politician are now in line against it in the same way that, you know, it affected tobacco companies. We are now seeing a major paradigm shift in that area, and it's just no longer – the combustion engine is the main point for a car is just no longer profitable in the way that it was, and it's no longer sustainable in the way that it was. It was based on an illusion, and now that's going away. Secondly, the insofar as politicians and their fear of being, you know, reelected and getting money so they can be reelected on the one hand, that's a flaw, but it's also a flaw you can exploit. It's one of those areas where you keep pressure on them, keep getting involved. You know, I have my chip on my shoulder about the independents because they kind of stand off to the side until an election comes or until an issue comes up without being constantly involved and therefore kind of abdicating their responsibility as citizens and stuff. And I, you know, as much as I differ, you know, I differ with the, you know, the right, they certainly do put their time in. And now I think it's time for Democrats to start putting our time in the same way you want a future that moves in a positive sense towards a technology future. If you want us to grow as a country, if you want our economy to be based on things that are sustainable, healthy, smart, and, you know, and not damaging to the environment or our physical bodies, then you have to make that case. Because right now, there are vested financial interests who spend a lot of their time making their case in the other direction. So those are the things. Use the fact that they're afraid of not getting reelected, and allow that flaw to work in your for your benefit. I'm going to go to. I've only got a minute left or so. I want to go to Nancy in Minneapolis because she's got the same outrage I think I have about. Are you there, Nancy?
Yes. Hiya. Yes. Oh, my gosh, I'm just outraged about President Obama's speech on Tuesday and how school districts are allowing schools to not
opt
show
out of
speech.
It.
Exactly, right. Or give excused absences. This is the president of our country, like it or not.
Right.
Did they ever question any of Bush's speeches? No, they did not. Exactly. I want to know. This poor man, he wants to do good for this country.
Right.
He's going to give a speech encouraging kids to stay in school and do well, and they're worried about it? What the heck?
I know. Well, you got
my blood is boiling. I'm so angry.
Absolutely, and you have every right to be. And it's one of those things where you need to call, you know, your school board. Again, this is, you know, all politics being local. Talk to your school board, your representative, and stuff, and go. I think that that, you know, if you're going to have a person in a situation where they're going to be an automatic role model, such as the president, I think it's important that he takes this kind of an issue head on. And what he's really trying to do is prepare these kids. If you're looking 20 years down the line and saying America is slowly slipping, or even quickly, depending on how you look at it, slipping behind in technology, we need to start now to make sure our kids can compete in the future. This is the, you know, this is, we've got to prepare a workforce for the type of work that's coming. And then you have parents pulling their kids out of school.
I just don't understand the mentality.
Well, I think that's healthy on your part, because there's no way to understand that mentality, because it's absurd.
No, it is.
Yeah.
It is absurd. And they should not give excused absences if parents keep them home.
Yeah, it's like turning idiocy into a religious holiday. It doesn't make
exactly
any sense to me at all. Thank you so much. I have to take a break. Thank you so much, Nancy. Excellent, excellent point. And 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'm going to take a couple more calls when we come back on the break. And then after that, I have John Farmer, who was senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission. And I want to talk about his book, The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11, which ties into this, you know, our you know, the tethers that are on us to foreign oil. It's stunning. It'll be a great conversation. But I'll also take your calls after we get back. 1-800-STEP-12. I'm Hal Sparks. This is the Stephanie Miller Show.
Big place where dreams come true.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
I've done questionable things.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. It's my last day in studio, and it's just, I gotta say, it's blazing by. This topic is just, it's A, the phone lines are fired up. B, the guests are fantastic. We're going to end the show today with Henry Rollins coming on, and he's not going to know what hit him, I think, by the time we get to it, because we'll all be nerded up and kind of blindside him with the kind of stuff I want to talk about. But 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I want to take some more calls, because in the next half hour at 7:30, we've got John Farmer, senior counsel of the 9/11 Commission, talking about his book, The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. I want to talk to Matthew in Dallas, Texas. Matthew, you there?
Hey, Hal.
Hiya.
Oh, my God, I'm basking in your awesomeness right now.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, it's nice when we start getting on a topic like this, and you see how engaged people get instantly. It's really reassuring.
Oh, talk about technology. You have me on. Well, I'm 20 years old. I was born in 1989, so I've had kind of the unique pleasure of kind of growing up in this revolution of digital media and technology being used for the betterment of mankind. But what I think is going to have to happen is my generation, before any of these humongous massive reforms where we can fully utilize this amazing, you know, almost otherworldly technology to better our world in terms of environmentalism, in terms of human health care, I mean, just anything.
Progress in general, right.
My generation is going to have to be the one to pick up the ball, enter politics, and say, okay, we understand how this works. We understand that this needs to happen. This needs to happen for this needs to happen. And unfortunately, it seems at least at this point that my generation is anybody born after like 1990. We're still kids, so we're not even thinking about entering politics.
But
we're
again,
just kind of.
But I'll tell you where you can. I'll tell you where you can make an impact and where you will. And I've only got a minute left, so I'm gonna. I'll let you go. Thank you so much for the call, Matthew. You are. I think Dionne Warwick is right. You are our future. So. but thanks so much. Where you are going to be able to make an impact, and I don't want you to lower your expectations in any way about what you can do at your age, is you can become an an entrepreneur. You can actually start driving this whole thing, because that shift will happen and will drive politics. If politics follows money, then start making money doing this stuff. Really pick up the ball and running with it. If you've got a great idea, if it starts with you making an Apple app, you know, for the iPhone, and then grows into your own software company, more power to you. I'll be back after this with John Farmer. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
The hell's the matter with you?
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Moots while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. But right now, I have on the line John Farmer, senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, who wrote the book The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. John, are you there?
Yes, Hal. Thank you for having me. Appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
My pleasure. This is... to say this is a highly contentious and constantly debated issue is the understatement of the millennium, I think. and especially where the 9/11 Commission is concerned. The truther movement feels, I think, towards the 9/11 Commission the way most thinking Americans now think about the Warren Commission. It's just kind of like a political piece of paper put forth to kind of quiet dissent or worry or concern or you know, just like kind of like a cop standing at the corner going, nothing to see here, move along, you know.
I think the majority of Americans have a much more accurate and realistic view of the work that we did. We were put in existence to find the facts, and that's what we did. And I make no apologies whatsoever for the work that the 9/11 Commission did. I think it was an extraordinary effort by an extraordinary group of people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, so what is your response to the, the sort of constant, attitude that there are a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of questions that keep coming up again and again that weren't addressed necessarily in the 9/11 Commission report, or were summarily dismissed, and that people just feel like, you know, points to a bigger conspiracy, whether it does or not. But that's, you know,
yep.
But that, you know, those questions weren't adequately answered, according to a large swath of the American populace.
Well, I can understand where that sentiment comes from, because the reality that we discovered on the commission is that the version of events that we were given by the government after 9/11 and up until the 9/11 commission was simply not the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly with respect to the day of 9/11 and the national response, which is the specific focus of the ground truth.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand, you know, when the government puts out a version of things that isn't true and people find out that it isn't true, then of course speculation runs wild.
Right.
And you know, the book sets forth, you know, how that story evolved and the ways in which it wasn't in accord with reality. So I understand where the sentiment comes from. I think some of the theories that have been spun out are frankly not grounded in reality. And in fact, you know, what I wanted to do in the book is mm-hmm. to basically tell the story of 9/11 the way it was actually lived by the people who were responding to the emerging Al Qaeda threat in the years, months, weeks, days, hours, minutes, and seconds of the attack. And I wanted to do that for a couple of reasons.
Or not responding, as the case may be.
As the case may be. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of reasons why I wanted to present the history that way.
Right.
One is it obviously has an inherent human interest. I mean, it's an inherently dramatic story.
Mm-hmm.
There were people acting in good faith, trying to get the word out and trying to make government work, trying to reorient government from a Cold War posture to meet this new threat. So there's the human drama involved in their attempts, which ultimately failed on 9/11, but nonetheless, their attempts to do that. Secondly, what becomes clear when you see the history laid out is that the chaos that existed on the morning of 9/11 was the trailing consequence and inseparable from
the developments of the last 10 years in trying and failing to reorient government to meet this new threat. And the point I'm trying to make is that the division of government that emerges from the true story of 9/11 is basically an apparatus that is barely competent, and certainly not competent enough to carry off some grandiose conspiracy.
Well, that's entirely possible. I suppose I just think carrying off a grandiose conspiracy isn't actually as hard as you might think it is. Corporations do it all the time when they bury waste in the desert and it gets into groundwater and kills a bunch of people. It only takes, you know, 10 truckers not knowing what they're burying and two executives signing the, you know, memos the right way. Ultimately, a very small group of people with a very negative agenda can make a large group of people with a positive agenda do a lot of awful things. I mean, that history has shown that many, many times.
Well, my experience in government, and certainly the history that's set forth of the developments in the 90s and the early years of this century, mm-hmm. I think would basically call into question the capacity of government, which differs from corporations, by the way, in the extent of public scrutiny that the government is subjected to. But it calls into question the capacity of government to carry off anything on a scale like that. There was a story of 9/11 that was put out that mm-hmm. wasn't true, and
right.
we found that out. And basically the essence of the untruth was that by the time of the third flight, American 11. Mm-hmm. American 77, heading towards Washington, that the national command structure had reasserted itself and was functioning the way it should and properly, and that simply wasn't the case. What we found the truth to be was that with respect to the last two flights, there really was no effective notice and there was no effective opportunity for the military to respond.
They were busy doing other things.
Well,
that day.
No, they weren't busy doing other things. They were trying to respond, but they were forced by the failures of communication, which beset the government throughout the 90s and continued that day, to improvise in the face of this threat that, you can argue had been in existence for almost a decade, and the government simply had failed to reorient itself to respond to it.
Well, I recognize the kind of decades-long one, but I mean there was an actual specifically crucial aspect of it in the August report just before it. You know. Our dealings with the Middle East have been dangerous for quite a long time, I think. But there was definitely an acute nature to this that was during the first year of the Bush administration and their lack of interest in pursuing it, having not had convened a meeting on terrorism at all when they entered in, regardless of the fact that Tenet was saying this is going to be the biggest priority of your presidency, leading up until 9/11, just doing next to nothing in regard to that. And then, you know, literally blowing off that PDB. That's different than, you know, a governmental institution, you know, spending 10 years not being ready for it, because quite frankly, in the last few years of the Clinton administration, they certainly had been. It had been a major focus for them, but the Bush administration came in and said it wasn't a priority for them. And during that time where it wasn't a priority, that's when we got hit.
What's consistent throughout the history of this mm-hmm. is these disconnects that occurred that where the ball gets dropped between agencies, within agencies, among agencies, within administrations, between administrations, and that's part of the tragedy of the story. And what I would say is that's an indication of the incapacity of government to carry off some of the more grand conspiracy theories that are out there. But there's no question that you're right. I mean, there were disconnects. And one of them that occurred was the disconnect between the Clinton administration and the Bush administration and handing the ball off. And
right. Well, there's two, disconnect is a good word for it, but there are many ways a disconnect happens. You can accidentally kick a cord out of a wall and disconnect your computer, or you can actually pull the plug on something. And I think what the Bush administration did was more tantamount to pulling the plug rather than just, I think the terminology dropping the ball or the terminology of disconnect makes it sound all accidental, and I think that's where the conspiracy theories find root, is that there's no one in the Bush administration taking solid responsibility for it, and the people like Richard Clark, who came out and said we did fail you, that there was you know, an active choice not to pursue something that was a genuine threat. And that's what allowed this to happen, is why people carry forth, you know, such a strong conspiracy theory. Because at a certain point you go, okay, if they're actively not pursuing this, then they have a reason for not actively pursuing this. They have, there's a vested interest in this. There's some money to be made. There's a value to be made. There's some control in government that they'll be able to have if this happens. And that's where, that's the seed of all these conspiracy theories, is it not?
The difficulty, though, with that argument is that, you know, the Bush administration, you know, left much of the anti-terror apparatus in place. Richard Clark was still in place. Louis Freeh was in place until that summer. George Tenet was in place. So the main warriors against the threat remained in place. Now, I think that you're right, though, that it didn't enjoy the level of priority that it had under the Clinton administration, simply because they hadn't lived through what the Clinton administration had lived through. So I think there's some truth in that, but it, you know, I think that the Bush administration thought that by leaving the major players in place, that the issue would be handled, and as a consequence, may not have paid sufficient attention to
which,
it.
Which I think is, you know, is a sort of is a slacker way of handling a major government issue. I mean, if you're going to come into us and say I think it's handled, and then ultimately we find out that it was the disconnect between the CIA, the FBI, the DOD. And you know, these disconnects are what caused it to effectively, quote unquote, slip through the cracks, or the ball to get dropped, or things to become caused by a disconnect, means that it was the coordination that should have been a priority for the Bush administration was not there. That, you know, if you're saying that, if everyone is saying that basically it was the CIA and the FBI weren't talking to each other, who's the bridge between those organizations that's responsible for that? If you put people in charge that were left over from the Clinton administration and then you don't talk to them or let them talk to each other, you bear the brunt of the responsibility, and I think that's where the Bush administration falls into this, and that's where I think people feel really weird about a lot of the details that come out when you find out that, you know, George Bush Sr. was having, you know, breakfast on the same day with a relative of Osama bin Laden, and the buildings fall at free fall. They're the first buildings to ever do that. When you, you know, when you have steel column buildings consumed by fire for the first time in history and those kind of things, this is where it starts to gain ground, because you either have to believe that they were horribly, violently incompetent, or you have to believe it was on purpose. Both are not good choices, and both seem to be people seem to stand at arm's length away from. You know, as far as the legacy of the Bush administration,
Well, I think you also listen. I think it's a futile exercise to try to lay blame on one administration or the other. I think they both.
I don't think so. I think there's a very distinct. No. I think you can very distinctly say who was running things at the time and who allowed. I mean, if you have evidence that they were, you know, that Bush was literally.
What we do know is that by the time the Bush administration took office, the 9/11 conspirators were in the United States, and we had senior members of the former Clinton administration basically have indicated, including Richard Clark, that it's unlikely that they could have been stopped at that point. So I think we need to move past this, you know, pointing the finger at one administration or the other, and acknowledge that this was a failure of government itself.
I think that's a strong point of disagreement, because I think government is far too broad. I have the same issue when people, you know, a huge chemical company like Dow or Monsanto dumps a bunch of chemicals into the groundwater in India and kills a bunch of people, and then people rally against Dow or Monsanto. And when we all know it was the current president and three of the board members who were in charge of this one particular project, these are the guys who are criminally responsible for what actually happened, who actually, you know, that's where a conspiracy is born. It's not born in an entire organization. I don't think a conspiracy of, you know, exists that's big enough to include, you know, the soldiers on the ground, or the, you know, the first responders, or even the generals in charge of, you know, our Air Force. I don't think that's there at all. But I do think that people in charge can either through incompetence or through active choice set up a situation where these things can get through. If it's like saying to me, what you're saying to me about, you know, these people being in place and having a plan, is that that cops can't ever stop an attempted murder or stop someone who's planning commit a crime, even though the evidence is there, which happens all the time. And the cops get the credit for stopping the guy before it happens.
I don't think that's what I'm saying at all. I'm just saying, I'm just pointing out what officials of the Clinton administration itself have pointed out, which is, look, by the time of early 2001, it was very late in the day in terms of being able to stop this. And they had already defeated every layer of American security that was in place throughout the 90s with respect to the CIA detection, with respect to immigration. So they had already defeated the vast majority of the defenses that were in place,
except for the fact that they still had to hijack planes to pull it off, and that was still the area of heightened alert and defense.
No question about that. There's no question that the administration that was in power bears responsibility. I'm simply saying that to lay it all on them is not fair.
I think to soften the blow by saying words like disconnect is not fair. I think they blame is one thing, but taking responsibility is another. And I think there's been a tremendous lack of taking responsibility by the Bush administration. I think they have used it as a tool to get what they want more so than they felt remorseful about the fact that it happened on their watch. That's the issue.
I think the real issue is, how do you learn from it? And I think one of the mistakes that they made, which was a pretty enormous one, was, and it's in part by basically telling a story about 9/11 that wasn't true, they blinded themselves to some of the realities that they might have been able to fix in time for Hurricane Katrina, which came along a few years later.
Right.
And what we see are the same kinds of mistakes being made in a very different kind of crisis, which tells you something.
Lack of concern. I think a lack of caring for those issues. I think they had an agenda that they were working, and they weren't interested in the other anything else that was outside of it to the country's detriment. I appreciate the call, and I think the book is terrific. I think people should read it. The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. John Farmer, thank you so much for being with us. I'm up against a tight break, so
thanks
for a great conversation. Appreciate it. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks. We'll be back right after this.
Oh, my God! That's like my favorite show ever!
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
You figured, he's a loser, a deadbeat.
Well, aren't ya?
Well, yeah.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph while she's away on vacation. 1-800-STEP-12. It's my last day on the show. It's been a great show so far. It's very, fiery. We've been talking about all kinds of things, not the least of which is, 9/11, which we just talked about. And, of course, Vince from Chicago, you there?
Hey, Sparky.
Hey, thanks. That's my dad's nickname, actually. But go ahead.
I guess it's yours now. Hey, no. Bush inherited 9/11 from Bill Clinton.
Oh, he did? Were the planes actually flying when Bill left office? Was that what happened? Were they actually in the air when Bill left? Did it take like 3 months for them to leave the airport?
How many times were we attacked during the 90s by Al-Qaeda? And
once?
Colonel Chase.
And what happened? Those guys were caught and prosecuted?
What was the USS
On U.S. soil. I'm talking about on U.S. soil. Once, and those guys were prosecuted and put in jail. And in a court of law, by the way. They were actually kept in American prisons. We didn't have to create another prison for them.
Colonel Schaefer was conducting Operation Able Danger, and Jamie Gerlich shunned him. He had his eyes on Muhammad Atta, and there's nothing in the commission about that. And the docs that were taken out of National Archives by Sandy Berger, I bet you that Operation Able Danger was in that file.
Okay, well, that's something we'll never know. But okay, so but based on your logic, though, in this situation,
I think somebody should investigate Berger. Why isn't he in jail?
Because I don't think he committed any particular crime, and I don't think
he was in
a position of power.
But you think George Bush?
I'm just saying it's his responsibility. I'm not saying he committed the crime.
Are you one of those that wanted him arrested and tried for war crimes and all that?
I think the war in Iraq was a war of choice.
Well,
but I think
the left is going to get. You're not going to get any of those terrorist torture pictures that you want and all that stuff. You're not going to get any of that stuff. They're not going to.
I just want to be clear on one thing, though. I want to be clear on one thing for you, Vince.
For a 100 years.
Right.
You don't see Obama pulling us out of there. And he's up in his warmongering.
Okay, so Vince, but under your logic, though.
He inherited all that. So it's okay that he inherited all that, but Bush didn't inherit any of that.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. So you're comfortable with the idea. If you believe that Bush inherited from Bill Clinton the 9/11 situation, then you are very comfortable with the problems that Obama has inherited from the Bush administration, and you're comfortable with the changes that he has to make to solve them.
Well,
correct?
No, I'm just saying.
You don't.
Just
no,
saying,
you actually think.
I'm, no, I'm just saying that you guys. Obama complains all the time. I inherited all this stuff. I inherited all this stuff, and doesn't put any blame on the 2 years that Democrats had Congress in 2006 to 2008.
Right, with the Bush administration bulldozing that.
Then the right thing to do is to create more deficit, spend more money.
It actually is. If you follow how the economic recoveries work traditionally in history, deficit spending is actually one of the best solutions for it.
World War II got us out of the Great Depression.
Well, that's what we need is another war. Then that would really help things. Maybe you know what? It's just Because a dead guy can't flip a hamburger. That's why, Vince. I got to take a break because we're coming up against. You can't talk over that and actually have a conversation. Everything Obama does is bad. Everything Bush did was fine. So says Vince. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. Right after we get back, we're going to talk to Representative Joe Sestak of Pennsylvania. He will be challenging Arlen Specter in the primary. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation for my final hour. That's right. It's the last hour of the week. And then, Tony, the board op, is weeping. This week has blazed by, has it not? It's been crazy. Representative Sestak will be with us in a moment. He's met some sort of delay, so we'll be with him in a second. I'm going to take your calls. 1-800-STEP-12 in a moment of since I've got your rapt attention. I will be here in Los Angeles at Largo at the Coronet next on September 10th, Thursday, September 10th, doing stand-up, which is wonderful. I'll be at the Laughing Skull Lounge in Atlanta the week after that. First week of October, I'm in Chicago at the Chicago Improv, and the week after that, I'm at Cobb Comedy Club in San Francisco. So StephanieMiller.com, they will have all my stuff, all the dates up and everything. I want to go through. There are a couple of people who are still held over, by the way, from when we were talking about electric cars and wireless energy, and they've been holding on a long time. So I want to get to both of them about energy, because I still think it's important, and it's very tied into the 9/11 conversation we started to have. John in Amherst, you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you for holding on.
A couple things about Tesla. First, he did manage to find a way to tap the ionosphere for free power, and he was terminated as a result.
Right.
For those people that are interested, they should research Tesla Towers, T-E-S-L-A.
Right.
Secondly, his wireless energy transmission was through the Earth, as opposed to being radiated energy through the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, I did a paper on exactly that, and the power densities required would satisfactorily fry bacon. So it's something that have to consider very, very, very carefully. I just wanted to call your attention to those.
Well, I appreciate
it.
And absolutely. I think. Thank you so much, John. I think people will do well to pick up a biography or a story on Tesla just for the possibility. Really, you know, it's amazing reading. It reads like science fiction, the stuff that he was capable of doing. And if even a third of the technology he created was, you know, usable, it would be a game changer on how we live. And I also want to go to Nancy in Buffalo. Nancy, you there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks a lot for your brilliant analysis. I'm very impressed. I was just calling in relation to the importance of our future public policy and how this relates to our health and the environment.
Mm-hmm.
One example I wanted to give is insulating material in homes. Now, fiberglass has been being used extensively as an insulating material, and it's a very poor insulating material, and it's actually a health hazard.
Mm-hmm.
And now, for example, in New York State here, we have the the Energy Star program,
uh-huh.
and it requires fiberglass insulation in new homes. I was looking at a new home, and it was really disgusting. The basement had this kind of fiberglass all around the interior of the basement on the walls, and it was only protected. It only protected the people in the basement with a thin layer of aluminum foil over the insulation.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of standard in construction these days.
Yeah, I mean, it was ridiculous because fiberglass is not a good thing to be breathing into your lungs.
I agree. That's an excellent point. I got to move on because I've got Joe Sestak on the line, and we'll go to him right now. Thank you so much for the call. Representative Joe Sestak from Pennsylvania. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Hal, and thank you. I'm sorry I'm a tad late here.
It's all right. You're a busy man, and rightly so. There's a lot going on. So I wanted to talk to you about Afghanistan. I read your op-ed in the I read it off of Philly.com, but in the Philly Daily News, and there are a couple of things that really stuck out. I mean, obviously, this has become a contentious issue. You got George Will calling for an immediate withdrawal. These are the guys, by the way, who all during the Bush administration couldn't wait to stay longer anywhere we were with guns out. Now all of a sudden, because it's on Obama's watch, they're very happy to start going, well, the longer he keeps us in there, the bigger a failure he is, that kind of thing, without ever talking about all the details that it requires in dealing with the problem, what we're actually dealing with. And it's a very complicated issue. So I'd love for you to talk for a second on that, if you could.
Absolutely. If I might, look, here's how I look at the set of cards, the hand of cards that our president has been handed by the previous administration. It was like, in this case, in Afghanistan, after going into that tragic misadventure in Iraq.
Right.
But all of a sudden, by the time this president took over and they're ignoring Afghanistan, is it was sort of like having a patient come into an emergency room basically with a heartbeat flatlined.
Right.
And all of a sudden, president is at least is resurrecting the person, might be in ICU right now, but this is going to take a bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
And he has acknowledged that the goal there has had to change, and that goal is focused on eradicating the safe haven that Al-Qaeda has within Pakistan. Afghanistan's almost more of a base from which we cannot let Al-Qaeda, who struck us at 9/11, strike us again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, that's what he's focused on. Second, we do need the president to provide benchmarks for how we can measure success and failure, particularly as our redeployment from Afghanistan does need to occur.
Right.
And he needs to make sure that we are clear, though, here in America, that the 20,000 Taliban troops we're fighting, 70% are there because of wages. They just want a job.
Right.
And so how he tells us he's going to help push aside the 30% that are still there and fighting us harshly in Afghanistan with the Taliban, while leaving behind some modicum of stability so you don't have a rich bed from which terrorists can regrow, that's the key we still have to wait from the president, which he has said we should have in the next month.
Yeah, he's. I hear that he's planning a major speech on this or a major policy directive in the next couple of weeks. And I think, honest to God, I honestly believe that there's definitely a strategy going on here. I think most of the confusion comes in the news that's coming one way or another, because it's obviously we're dealing with some sort of push from the Pakistani side and a push from the Afghani side to kind of squeeze this area that they've used as a safe haven for a while. And that was the plan when he first came into office, and that seems to be what's going on. And the call for more troops seems specifically directed towards that end. The only question is, how do we know when we've won and how can we get out of there? It's a very murky area of the world.
And if there's anyone who can clarify it, mm-hmm. it is this president. Look, right. he's already starting to change the military strategy to where it's not counter-terrorist, which just hunt down and kill. It's, hey, wait a moment, counterinsurgency is what we want. Protect the natives who are there,
right.
winning their trust, feeding in programs like the National Solidarity Program, which is a microloan program.
Mm-hmm.
Very little bit of money, but that's all they need to start some businesses other than opium production.
Right.
Then they do have to make sure, as part of this protecting of the citizens, winning their trust, their hearts and minds, that they do eradicate the 30% of the 20,000 of the Taliban that there. So that strategy takes a while to change.
Right. And you have to. He's also being a lot. He's also being a lot more careful with these policies as best he can too. So because he knows that the more civilians we kill through drone attacks and the like, the it sets us back further than if we'd have managed to kill someone that was a high value target because of the stability that we're trying to achieve in Afghanistan before we leave.
Absolutely. He recognizes that militaries do not fix problems. They may stop a problem,
mm-hmm.
but to fix a problem, it ultimately takes the other elements of our power, the economic assistance, the diplomatic thrust to bring the warlords to a certain part, to our side of the table.
Right.
Those types of powers that the past administration said, okay, we got a problem, send the military in.
Mm-hmm.
What? How are we going to fix something with the military? We stop something from harming us with the military. But if we don't want that problem to remain after we depart, the other elements of power have to work. And that's what this president has wise vision upon.
Right. And, I think even at one point the military commanders were calling it a tourniquet during the Bush administration, that they were going to kind of squeeze the Al-Qaeda idea. A tourniquet is a temporary fix.
Yes.
And if you keep it on, it kills the thing it's trying to save. And I think that's the shift we have to make, and that's what makes it difficult. I think it was interesting, Richard, you said in your op-ed, Richard Holbrooke, the envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, said the success in the region is like pornography. We'll know it when we see it, and that's not really helpful. I think a good series of benchmarks are a great idea, and I think we can probably expect that from Obama sometime in the near future.
They told us about 6 months ago we'd have it in about 6 to 9 months, and so we're getting it here. I wish it had been sooner, quite frankly, because
right.
Americans who have poured 8-9 years into two wars want to understand, particularly in the midst of a sovereign recession, what are we getting for that investment? But you know what? 2 years ago, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, in Iraq, we do what we must. In Afghanistan, we do what we can. My gosh,
right.
This should have been exactly 100% different.
Right. Well, it sounds
where they struck us from.
Right. Right. And it's almost like, in Afghanistan, we do what we must. And in Iraq, we do what we want, which is really what became the case. It became this exercise in the desert in Iraq, where Afghanistan was really where we were dealing with specifically the threat that came against the country.
I was on the ground very early in the war in Afghanistan for a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I stuck. I headed the Navy's anti-terrorism unit in deep blue, and I had the opportunity to see what we were doing, and we were on the right path. Then I brought my carrier battle group over, and then I went on the ground about 18 months later for a short period and saw, after we diverted our attention, our resources to Iraq, how we had lost the sense of purpose, mission, focus, and resources in Afghanistan. We went into a deep, deep canyon. And so that's what this president is dealing with. And I think he needs some time.
Mm-hmm.
He does need to tell the public, because we asked it of the Bush administration, and we should do it ourselves. To say, here is very clearly is my strategy, here's very clearly are the benchmarks I'm measuring that success or failure upon. But I also believe that we should understand that this president has begun to restore a proper engagement in the world where it's with all elements of our power, and those that lead aren't our military. That's the backbone.
Right.
Not the ribcage of our effort to have a more peaceful, prosperous world.
Right. I think it's fascinating to watch how this, the difference between how Obama handles these kind of foreign issues than the Bush administration. If you look at Iran, is now interested in coming to the table again and is fine with limiting its enrichment. We've really made amazing strides there, even through the difficulty that they've gone through. And Afghanistan is a very tenuous, you know, country. It's what I think it's just, you know, it's nearly a failed state almost its entire history. You know, it's always been on the verge of just warlord and fiefdoms. That's not going to be easy to fix.
No. But because of the different approach he's taking, this will not be like the Russians. Look, when the Russians went into Afghanistan, they killed 1 million Afghanis. And they dislocated from their homes 5 million. That's why a 250,000 person insurrection arose against their behavior. See, we're taking a different approach now with this president. And even before that, we weren't the types of, we did it wrongly by not protecting the citizens and thinking it was just seek and destroy. But I think under his wisdom, a strategic approach again to Afghanistan, and as you well said, to places like Iran, where we outsourced our leadership, we wouldn't talk to them until they already met our negotiating end position.
Right.
We outsourced our leadership to give it to, like, the European Union to lead. No, no. If I learned anything when I was President Clinton's director for defense policy, it is that nations and groups are less willing to take risk for peace unless honest U.S. leadership is out there moving them towards it. And that's what we need elsewhere, from North Korea to Iran to Afghanistan.
Right. Well said. And if anybody wants to, they can go to philly.com. I think it would serve them well to read your opinion piece that is there, because it's called Time to Finish the Job in Afghanistan, and it's fantastic. Representative Joe Sestak, thank you so much for being on. I wish you well in your future political endeavors. I will leave it at that. I'm a big supporter, and I think you're a wise and an intelligent man. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Hal. Thanks for having me aboard, and I look forward to it again.
Absolutely. Cheers. Thank you so much. Representative Joe Sestak, 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We'll be coming back in a minute, and I'll take some of your calls. And then, of course, we got John Fugelsang at 8:30, and then at 8:45, Henry Rollins will be with us. Very exciting. Stay with me. I'll be with your calls in a second. Hal Sparks filling in on The Stephanie Miller Show.
And we'll be right back.
It's The Stephanie Miller Show.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I've only got a few minutes to take some of your calls, so they're going to be a bit rushed, and I apologize for that. So we're going to power through them, because I got John Fugelsang coming up and Henry Rollins at the bottom of the hour. Kim in Chandler, Arizona. You're there.
I am, Hal.
Fantastic. You believe, like I do, that Bush deserves a lot of the responsibility. If you don't want to use the word blame, I'm comfortable with that. Responsibility for 9/11.
Oh, I'm comfortable with the word blame, but I wish to God that he would do the right thing and accept the responsibility for the mess he created these past 8 years.
Yeah.
And I wish that the people on the right would step back, look at everything, and come to the same conclusion.
Right. I appreciate the call. I don't think they're ever going to do that, though. I really don't. I've only got a couple of minutes. Vinny in Wisconsin.
Hey, Hal. What's going on?
How are you?
Hey, I just wanted to call and see what you thought about how far the cars would be along if they wouldn't have scrapped that EV1.
Dude, I totally agree. You know, there was some argument about, you know, people going, you know, the EV1 was a piece of crap and it didn't quite work the way they said,
well,
blah, blah, blah. But it was first generation. That was the whole point.
Yeah, no. And it did 200 miles on a charge. And our electric cars now can barely get that.
Right, exactly. But
that was shortly after they signed on to take over Hummer, which is kind of coincidental. How
you
going to sell an electric car when you got a big gas guzzler sitting right next to it?
Well, you'd think it would balance the market. I appreciate the call, Vinny. You know, if you've got an electric car that you sell half the time and you sell Hummers to the other group, then one should subsidize the cost of the R&D of the other. That way you can diversify in technology, which is a way, systems actually, survive in the wild. Priscilla wants to make a real quick point on 9/11. Priscilla in Wisconsin, you there?
Hi, Hal.
Hi.
I'd like to talk about something that I haven't heard you address yet, and that is that 9/11 security was handled by Marvin Bush.
Oh, yes.
George's youngest brother.
Who curious.
A principal of a company called Securicom that provided the security for World Trade Center and United Airlines and that international airport where at least one of the planes came from.
There's a lot of that happening in the Bush family. Oh,
right.
Thanks so much for the call. I'm up against a hard break. You know, my favorite thing is Google the Reagan conspiracy theories. Those are really fun too, because apparently George W. Bush was actually having, I guess, lunch with or breakfast with Hinckley's brother.
Crazy.
Look that stuff up. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'll be back with John Fugelsang. This is Hal Sparks on the Stephanie Miller Show.
You can tell so much about a person from the way they live. Just looking around here, I can tell you're a genuinely dirty person.
Do not go in there. Woo!
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, cruising into my last half hour of the week. It's been a fantastic week. And I'm lucky enough to have on the line right now the incomparable John Fugelsang. John, you there?
Yes, I am, Hal. It's always great to hear you filling in for the Mooks.
Thank you. That's right, since no one can actually fill in for Steph, I feel like I'm just the stunt Mook for the week, and I just try to, you know, do as best I can. But even now, I have to fill in for an Emmy award-winning Mook, because, you know, Jim won an Emmy this on Monday.
I know.
It's fantastic, so.
I don't know what's happened to the Emmys, my God.
Oh, that's sweet. I'll tell him you said that, because God knows he can afford to take another shot on his self-esteem.
I know. What's he going to do? How's he going to hate himself with this going on?
Exactly. You've got that stupid statue glaring me in the face.
It's like a giant gold Zoloft lady sitting there just making him feel good about his own talents.
Well, like Zoloft, it can lead to all kinds of, you know, taste perversion and all kinds of odd side effects. You know, people who get Emmys end up being very weird. So it might work out in his favor. He'll have an excuse to be weird. There you go.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, Glenn Beck doesn't need one. Why should Jim?
That's true. That's true. Although I think weird is too small a word to describe Glenn Beck. I mean, have you been keeping track of did you see his art criticism?
Yeah, I did. And it's kind of ironic, because if Glenn Beck were any more unbalanced, he would be cubist. So I think it's great he's giving art lessons now.
Yeah, I think Fox is actually going to have to become fairly unbalanced as their new logo. We're Fox. We're fairly unbalanced. And the fairly part is just O'Reilly.
Yeah. Oh, well, of course. Of course. Well, he's a moderate.
Right. How crazy is that now?
Tell me about it.
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You're the guest.
Oh,
isn't that cool?
Well, hey, it's just been a crazy week, and I mean, it's been really amazing. We're finally witnessing the town halls winding down, and it's going to be, I guess, all about Obama's big speech on Wednesday.
Yeah, and of course his indoctrination of his new Hitler Obama youth on Tuesday, which is, you know, the big scare tactic from the right now. You know,
yeah, you know, if only he had just read My Pet Goat while our country was under attack, we could have felt proud.
That's the patriotic. That's a patriotic thing to do, you know. Yeah. And by the way, read it poorly, like it's new to you and you're confused.
I got to keep telling all my conservative friends, you know, you keep calling Obama a radical, anti-war, pro-gay, brown-skinned socialist who isn't even American, and I'm like, sorry, you're talking about Jesus.
Right. That's true. Well, you know, if you look at how the family views what Jesus has said, it's no surprise that they're not fans of that stuff either.
Oh, I know. Jesus would hate giving health care to the poor. My God, it's up to Christians to deny care to the sick.
Absolutely. If Christians were, you know, as they are in their current form, were running around back then, they'd basically be standing in front of, you know, in between Jesus and the leper going, hey, Jesus, what do you think you're doing? You're missing out on a great economic stream there, you know?
Exactly. Make the leper give a copay.
Right.
But, you know, but it's not all Christians. There's plenty and plenty of great progressive Christians who are really fighting right now really hard. You don't see them on the news too much, but there's a lot of people who've actually, you know, read the Gospels and know that Jesus didn't tell Lazarus death was a pre-existing condition.
Right. Well done. And of course, you know, those people got on a big phone call. There was like a 1,000-person strong phone call that Obama had, this kind of phone religious town hall that he had, to kind of get that specific message out, that this is about caring for the electorate, for caring for people who can't protect themselves.
Exactly. I was one of the people on that phone call. And, you know, it's amazing when you think about how much money we're spending on Iraq. $1 billion a week is still being spent in Iraq, ostensibly to fight terrorism. Now, we know a lot more people die of cancer every year than die of terrorism. So maybe we could waterboard a tumor. But
right.
I'm like, if fighting terrorism is a patriotic duty, why isn't fighting illness perceived as a patriotic duty?
Exactly.
And I'm really sorry. Obama's dropped the ball on this. I'm hoping he gives a good speech. But you know what? They have a lot of celebrities in their Rolodexes, and I haven't seen one big shot star, especially a Canadian, come to Obama's defense. I really, really would like to see Rahm Emanuel start enlisting the celebrities before it's too late and get the massive PR machine. You know, Will.i.am could just do another video tomorrow and sway public opinion on this. And
absolutely.
If he drops the ball anymore, they're going to have to hire him for the Mets, because it's been really, really depressing seeing how they have just let themselves be a John Kerry punching bag for the last month.
I think I do think it was an interesting choice, and I do think there's a bit of rope-a-dope going on. And, you know, I think they got some hits they weren't expecting, as you do when you're playing rope-a-dope. But I do think that he wanted these guys to spend their ammo during the month of August, when traditionally a lot of people aren't paying a lot of attention to the news. It is the last moment to go on vacation before the summer starts, or before the new school year starts, and before business starts up fresh again. And I think in a lot of ways, this is the best time to have burned out all the ridiculousness and start having a substantive argument, substantive conversation. I think the timing is good in that regard.
I hope you're right, because I really would like to see these guys start pushing back, and I want Obama to start naming names of who's taking money from the insurance companies. You know, we already have death panels. It's the people who deny grandma your claims. We've got them already.
Absolutely.
Any politician who uses the word death panel deserves to go before a douche panel, and I want to see Obama kick him around some on Wednesday night.
Right. Well, I think, you know, we've gotten into this habit that we experienced with the Bush administration, where there was such, you know, their policies were dictated with, you know, crayons and sledgehammers. There was no, you know, they literally wrote stuff on a napkin and said, do this, and, you know, and it got done. And we got, and on the one hand, really furious that there wasn't more discussion about these things, and yet mildly impressed that they were able to push through what they got through. Now, granted, a lot of that has been turned around since Obama came in. He's been, you know, undoing those signing statements, and that's the danger of doing it that way, that if you do it too quickly and too, you know, directly like that, the next administration can just toss it out. That's kind of the argument for why Don't Ask, Don't Tell is taking the time it's taking, or DOMA, for example, is going to have to be a legislative shift, which takes time. And it's very frustrating when you're on this side after we've sat through 8 years of this, and largely, you know, if you're looking at 8 years of Clinton as a fiscal conservative, you know, real true progressivism has been on hold since Carter.
Exactly.
And, you know, and it's very frustrating. But, you know, I don't think it's going to not be frustrating during this next period. But I do have hope. I do see that you know, again, the stimulus package. Remember, everybody was flipping out almost exactly how they are now about it getting passed. Remember, we thought it wasn't going to get passed because everybody was fighting it. There was not a single Republican vote. Everybody was flipping out. And then it went through. And then,
absolutely. Yeah. But you know what? I'm looking forward to seeing him dismantle even more, because I'm a bit nervous, as you are, about Afghanistan. You know, Afghanistan's kind of like the Star Wars prequels. It really seemed like a good idea at the time, and now we're wondering why we had to go through all this.
Right.
And you're right to mention Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton balanced the budget every year he was in office. The last time any Republican balanced a budget was Nixon, which takes away their right to be called conservatives. You can't be a conservative when you spend money like Courtney Love in Amsterdam, and that's the number one rule with these guys. They're not conservatives. They're not even capitalists. They stopped being capitalists when they began rewarding failure.
Well, they're corporatists.
If you're afraid of competition, if you're afraid of drugs from Canada, a public option, you're not a capitalist anymore.
Right, because you don't believe in, you know, in the power of collective bargaining. You don't believe in the power of investment. You don't believe in that. You believe in bully capitalism, this idea, you know, that if you're in charge now, you you deserve to stay in charge no matter how you got there, and anybody who comes up doesn't get the same chance as you.
It's cronyism. It's like the mafia. Bush makes you an offer he can't understand. And we got to remind people over and over again, you know, these town hall people need to direct their anger back at Bush and Cheney, the people who got them into this.
Right.
If your captain hit the iceberg, you do not get to blame the rescue boat. And over here in New York City, we're getting all ready for the 9/11 anniversaries. And to see Cheney coming out again and exploiting what happened in a city that the Republican Party never cared about prior to 9/11, to see them exploiting 9/11 still to justify their illegal wars in
without ever taking responsibility for it in any way or any shape or form. It's
exactly.
Stunning.
9/11 is the greatest example in our history of a government not keeping you safe. Dick Cheney coming on Chris Wallace's fawning little fanboy session and saying that he kept you safe from terrorism for 7 years is like Bill Clinton saying he kept Hillary safe from adultery for the past 10.
Right.
It doesn't make sense.
It's absurd. John Fuel saying I'm up against a tough, hard break. I really want to thank you for coming on. I always love when I'm in the studio with you here in town, and I wish you all the best and good luck. And you'll be on, I'm sure, next week with Steph, as will I. So have a great Labor Day weekend. You're awesome,
and
I'll talk to you soon.
Great to hear from you. I'm headlining at Gotham Comedy Club in New York City this Monday night, Labor Day.
Fantastic. Everybody in New York, within shouting distance, go see him. Thanks so much. John Fugelsang. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. But right after the break, when we come back, we've got Henry Rollins in my final break for the end of the show. Very exciting. Stay tuned.
No need to thank us. It's what we do.
Who the hell are you guys?
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Loves the working man. Don't trust Whitey. See a doctor and get rid of it.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. It has been a great week, and it is about to get even better. Right at the tail end, best for last style. I have on the line Henry Rollins. What can you not? What label does not apply to Henry Rollins? Emmy Award winner, actor, musician. Legendary frontman of Black Flag. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm terrific. It's great to talk to you. I'm constantly amazed how you recreated who people saw you as many times over, and have. First of all, you're acting in you're coming up in Sons of Anarchy. You're going to be doing a six episode arc there.
Yeah, actually, it turned into more than six episodes.
Excellent.
But yeah, we're still working on that, and it's hard work.
Yes.
You know, it's a lot of tough guys, but it's excellent people, very very talented actor, and the crew were great, and our directors have been great. So it's been big fun for me.
That's awesome. Well, if they're lucky enough to have you, I'm sure they'll try their best to keep you around as long as is dramatically possible. You have made a career, in the spoken word area, and we've been talking about stuff all morning, from 9/11 to wireless energy, which is coming, to where we are in Afghanistan, to Dick Cheney's love fest with Chris Wallace.
Yep.
You've been very outspoken and on a lot of different things. And do you believe that there's anything that's off limits insofar as what you talk about?
Well, I think that some people with a microphone the size of a Glenn Beck or a Rush Limbaugh, they should acknowledge that they have First Amendment protection to say whatever they want. But with that comes a lot of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys seem to hide behind the First Amendment. Like, I can say anything I want. Yeah, but you're ginning up some people who are obviously clearly agitated, and you're getting them into kind of a frenzy. And if you're looking for your next Unabomber or Timothy McVeigh, this is a way to get that going. And I think, in a way, they know what they're doing. These are not stupid people. And that kind of manipulation of people who are full of fear and uncertainty, it's really irresponsible and extremely un-American. Unfortunately, it's legal. And so legality and responsibility don't always make the best match. That's the thing that bugs me with these guys, because they're not stupid, they really do know what they're doing. And when they keep hiding behind their right to say things like, well, okay, but you just want to say to them, why can't you all be cool? do something different.
Well, if you've noticed,
they just call you a sissy or whatever.
Right. Well, you notice that, like, Beck has had to walk back some of what he said on kind of a regular drip nowadays.
Well, only because the bottom line skirted away, and that's
right.
The money. That's the sponsors. As far as hate mail, he doesn't read it. As far as what you think of him, he'll never even know who you are.
Right.
It's when Procter & Gamble and these people say, you know, they get hot under the collar, that's when Fox listens, because that's the bottom line, is making that money.
Because none of these companies want to be on board the day he does crank one of these people enough to go on a shooting spree.
Right. And people would keep buying those products anyway, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But they are, you know, these people are very cautious of their bottom line. And Beck is, I don't know, he seems to be a deeply unhappy man who waits until he's on prime time to turn it loose.
Right.
His demons of discontent.
Right. It's stunning. I mean, some of the stuff lately, I mean, I personally think we're watching the unraveling of a human being. I think there's a lot to Rush Limbaugh that's very manufactured and that he intentionally does, you know.
Absolutely. He's a smart guy. He's
yeah.
a good broadcaster.
Right. But
you know,
I don't
really
think Beck.
What he's
yeah.
doing.
I don't think Beck necessarily qualifies on the same front. I think O'Reilly.
Skilled.
Beg your pardon?
He's not as skilled.
No, I think he's mentally kind of off the deep end in a lot of ways. I think he really does believe his own hype sometimes, and that's the danger of somebody like him.
Yeah, well, when you call the president a racist, and there's some blowback on that, I think I can't believe that he doesn't understand why some people are agitated. And on a side note, this thing hit me last night, and mm-hmm. I knew I'd be talking to you, and I just wanted to bring this up super
sure.
briefly. The last 8 years were very hard for me
mm-hmm.
And for a lot of people.
Right.
But if the next 4 to 8 years are like this, with all the implied racism and the incredible negativity, I don't know how I'm going to handle it. This is miserable.
Right.
Like when, you know, Barack's going to talk to the school children of America, that's being touted as some kind of Hitlerian indoctrination. This is just the pits. This is the utter nadir of American thought. And I can't believe that we are here. It's a drag.
I view it very much like kind of like the rise of celeb reality TV, and that it definitely has its spike and then it trails off. And there are people who will still be interested in it, but it, since it doesn't serve you in any length of thought, a lot of it will balance out, as it were. We're still in the first 9-10 months of his presidency, and I think when a lot of this stuff starts to pay off, like the stimulus package is starting to work, when health reform goes through in whatever form it gets through and it actually starts to benefit people, these hollow, horrible arguments will be in more stark contrast. But until then, you're right. It's just...
Well, Hal, I cling to your optimism. I want this to be over. And,
yeah.
and I want everyone in the Ku Klux Klan to have health care. And that idiot who called you Sparky and all of that,
right.
I want him to have health care, too. And I don't want him to lose his house because he gets a bad lung or breaks a leg.
Right.
And it's interesting when the captives... are being protected by the captors and shoot the liberators.
Right.
And that's what these town hall meetings are all about and all this idiotic behavior.
Right. Most of the people who don't have health care who are fighting against these things live in red states.
Yeah, and they're really being done a real disservice by these people who they're defending. And it's so crass
mm-hmm.
and so apparent. And
it's so fear-based.
I really love my country. You
mm-hmm.
know, how generic is that thought, because everyone says it. But I really wish we could move forward, and these guys just don't want to go.
Right.
And,
I wish
Barack Obama would, you know, I don't know, have some part of his anatomy drop down a little. Or maybe he is, he's a brilliant man, and maybe there's a bit of rope-a-dope or just patience going on. I'm kind of losing mine.
Yeah, well, I totally understand, because, well, we've been, you know, you and I think we're sitting in the same kind of, mental space in dealing with the Bush administration. All of our frustration is built up from them. You know, the reason the rope-a-dope was cool in the classic Ali fight was because it didn't last all that long.
Yeah,
you know,
only a few rounds.
Yeah, but it's as if we've been 8 years of rope-a-dope on our own, and then we watch the president do it, and I get what he's doing, but it's very frustrating to watch.
True, but as you said, mm-hmm. these things that have started to, you know, that have come out, like Cash for Clunkers,
right.
no matter what all these people say, it did work. It
yep.
was an outrageous success. Incredible.
Right.
It stimulated the economy, did exactly what it was supposed to do. And those people say that it was an utter failure. Mm-hmm. You see that they only bank in failure, and they only seek to divide. And that's why you see guys like Beck free freaking out when anyone criticizes him, because critical thinking is right out. And
yeah,
these guys have been, for 30 years or so, no one's really walked up and taken their lunch.
No.
And when people kind of even breathe on them, they really, they freak out. It's amazing. When they've been, like, you know, beaten up on liberals and Democrats to where so many of those guys is kind of, you know, they're just used to it.
Yeah. There's a normalcy in that. You know, it's why I think the shift over, like, the, you know, the Harry Reids of the party are, you know, a different crowd needs to come in, you know, because, quite frankly, they're just used to being the whipping boys. It's been,
yeah,
since Reagan. You know,
that's what I was intimating. Since Reagan, these guys have been very entitled, and there hasn't been a whole lot of things getting in the way of them doing everything from getting around the Geneva Conventions to having all kinds of fun with the Constitution to deregulating everything in sight. And when you say, I don't think liberals and Democrats are pushing for anything outrageous. They're just pressing for a kind of a more level playing field. And even that seems to be, you know, fighting words.
Right. Well, and you've got 86% of the populace, once they hear what reform really is, being for it very comfortably, and then you hear what goes back and forth in these Senate panels and stuff, it's very frustrating. You
and
know?
How grossly misinformed a lot of people are when you keep hearing people saying, get your government hands off my Medicare.
Right.
You're like, oh, come on. Get this guy a book and some fresh air and some vitamin
C. Yeah,
C.
You start pitying him because this guy's, you know, the guy who got his finger bitten off had it reattached with Medicare.
Yeah, I know. That
yeah.
happened down the street from where you and I are sitting right now.
Exactly. I want to thank you so much, Henry, for being on the show with me today. I want everybody to check you out on I would get the
Sons
show
of
right.
Anarchy,
yeah,
yeah,
Sons of Anarchy, and it's on FX. Fantastic. Always great to hear from you, and always a great point of view. Thank you so much.
All right, Hal. Have a good weekend.
Yeah. Cheers. Thanks. Wow, what a great way to end the show. Henry Rollins, folks. What a smart guy and a great, you know, they say voice of a generation for a lot of people, and he actually, that actually applies him in a great way. I'm Hal Sparks. It's been a fantastic week. I want to thank Rebecca Baker on drums. I want to thank Tony for being, and Craig, our intern. Have a great weekend. Steph will be back on Monday. You guys are fantastic. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.